Hello and welcome to Ag PhD Radio. I am Brian Hefty along with my brother Darren. We are broadcasting today from the Morton Studio. Today on the show, we're going to talk a little about alfalfa production, but we will get into many other topics as well. And if you'd like to call in, if you've got a question for us, or if there's anything you'd like to talk about that's happening on your farm right now, our number here is 844-44-AG-PHD. That's 844-442-4743. You can find us on Twitter, AgPhD Media, Darren Hefty or Brian Hefty, or you can email us, radio@agphd.com. We're going to get to the AgPhD mailbag pretty shortly here. We've been getting a lot of questions in, as you might imagine. It's spring, and it's just about planting time, the first planting date for crop insurance. Where we farm in South Dakota is April 10th. Well, guess what? That's tomorrow. I'm still hoping, Darren, to put a few acres in the ground, but I'm not, like, super optimistic. We got just a tiny, tiny little bit of snow today, and I don't care about the cold. The cold doesn't bother me, but is the soil going to be fit so we can get good seed-to-soil contact and good placement? That's the big question. What do you think?
The soil conditions last year on a super, super wet year, the best conditions we had all year were the first two fields we planted. And I look at this year, we've got decent soil conditions right now. And yeah, we got a couple of snowflakes in the air. Didn't amount to anything. If the soil conditions are fit, that's the biggest thing for me once we get past April 10th.
Yep. Now, a lot of people panic. And like last year, what hurt a lot of farmers is they got bad advice, especially from seed dealers saying, don't put the seed in the ground. It's too cold. What? No way. There is not a soil temp that's too cold that I am worried about. I mean, granted, yes, the soil temperature has to be above freezing. Otherwise, if it's not above freezing, you can't, I mean, you're not going to have soil that's fit. But as long as we've reached the crop insurance date, which for us is tomorrow, and as long as that soil is fit, we're planting. I don't care what the soil temperature is. Now, with the low soil temperature, certainly we want to make sure that we've got good cold germ seed. We want to have a good seed treatment. We want to do other things to pop the seed out of the ground faster, like even using a little bit of pop-up fertilizer, some insecticide, fungicide, that kind of thing. But I'm just saying, I'm not worried about the cold at all. Now, the other thing that we're going to do next week, because I think we're going to have some temps that are going to be clear down to maybe 15, 20 degrees overnight, hopefully we can put some tile in, because I don't think we're going to have the soil conditions fit next week for planting corn, but certainly fit for putting in tile. We've seen a lot of guys around us putting in tile. There was some tile went in just yesterday across the road from our farm. I went past a neighbor a couple days ago, different neighbor doing some. Actually, there was another neighbor, Darren, yesterday doing some within about 3 miles of our home farm. So lots of tile going in right now. It's a fantastic time to do that. So if you're waiting to put that seed in the ground, we'd really encourage you. Get some manure spread. Get herbicides applied. Get more fertility on. I know we're going to do a little of that work here the next few days, too. We're almost done, but not quite. Tiling, just anything else you can get done. Keep pushing it. And you know what I found? If we can stay busy out in the field, then our mind isn't all wrapped up in the whole COVID-19 thing. I've been talking to some farmers and agronomists that are getting depressed, and it's like, look, get out in the field. And all of a sudden, that issue, at least in your mind, is going to start going away. We got to keep our minds occupied with other things, and nothing better to occupy our minds with than the actual job of farming and feeding our planet. Darren, you got any other comments before we get to the Ag PhD mailbag?
Let's dive in. We got a lot of questions.
It's now mailbag time with Brian and Darren.
Okay, yesterday we were talking about stream barring in wheat, especially, and just fertilizing in wheat, and we never got a chance to get to this, but Tanner called in and wanted to ask the question, how does planting population and just population in general affect yield and protein levels in wheat and triticale? Darren, go ahead.
All right. Well, when you think about planting population, one of the things that concerns me is as we increase planting population, we need more nutrients feeding those stalks. We've got a lot more stalks out there we've got to take care of. And oftentimes what happens is we end up with problems in the field, whether it's lodging or different things, and we're really sourcing many of those problems back to nutrition. Now, when I think about protein levels, we need to have good levels of nitrogen and sulfur late in the season. What are the odds that we're going to have that and be able to do it in balance with a high level of potassium and other nutrients? I'm nervous about that, to be real honest with you. That's one of the reasons that I don't want people pushing populations too far. Then I look at what the world record growers are doing. They're using less population and getting more yield. So I don't know that necessarily having that high population is such a big deal.
All right. I would just say, yeah, I'm in agreement with that. And we have to be really concerned about feeding every plant that's out there. Darren said it exactly right on. The more plants you have, the more need you're going to have for certain nutrients. And then that could potentially be a draw on the nitrogen. And so, in other words, late in the season, you might not have enough to get your high protein levels. So the key thing for protein, again, is make sure that you've got ample nitrogen late in the season. All right, Mark from Kentucky wrote in again to us, and he had sent some questions in the other day, and I didn't get a chance to answer his last question. But anyway, he said with strip-till, they're going to do some strip-till acres, and his basic question here was mounted planter versus a drawn planter, he says, or pull-type planter. So, Mark, I don't know if I can really see a whole lot of difference between those two planters, but I will say this.
It depends on the terrain.
Yes.
It depends on the terrain. If you've got a lot of hills, if you've got a lot of windy places you got to go around, terraces and things, then it could make a difference. And having that mounted planter might be a nice thing for you.
Yeah.
It all depends on how you're controlling things and how you're able to follow those strips.
Yeah, and is it possible anymore to have RTK actually back on whatever tillage tool or planter or just anything that you are pulling? Yes, it is. So you could talk to your equipment dealer about that. But yeah, we want to keep things on the strip when you've made the strip. If you get off the strip a ways, I mean, you don't have to follow it exactly dead on in the center. That's kind of what our research has shown, but you got to keep it relatively close because if you get off that strip, you're not going to be super happy with your overall strip till and your planting. All right, well, we will be talking alfalfa production right after this.
Hey, Adam, new drone?
Not just any drone. I mounted a laser on it to take out weeds.
Look out for that tree. In the power lines.
Oh, it's heading for the house.
There's a simpler way to protect spring wheat from weeds. Perfect Match Herbicide. The broadest spectrum weed and grass control in one product. Learn more at PerfectMatchHerbicide.com. Always read and follow label directions.
The laser.
When it comes to my weed control, I know a head start can go a long way. That's why I spray early, so I can keep control all season long with a Roundup Ready Extend crop system, the system that makes the difference. This is my field.
Choose the Roundup Ready Extend crop system for control of more weeds than any other soybean system. Featuring Extendamax herbicide with vapor grip technology to manage tough-to-control weeds, including up to 14 days of soil activity, along with the field-proven performance of Roundup Ready to Extend soybeans. Now you have the right tools to extend your weed control and extend your yield with the system that makes the difference. Learn how you can put the system to work in your field when you visit RoundupReadyExtend.com. Extendamax is a restricted-use pesticide. Performance may vary. Always read and follow grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions. Check local regulations for specific requirements in your state.
Find your full potential and increase your bottom line with branded generic pesticides from Atticus LLC. Atticus offers a vast portfolio of branded generic fungicides, herbicides, and insecticides for row crops. Atticus puts grassroots experience and common sense logic to work to make product selection easier and on your terms. Growers across the region count on Atticus for relevant and reliable products that deliver results every time. Ask your local retailer about Atticus products and visit AtticusLLC.com to learn more. For value-based solutions you can trust, turn to Atticus. Always read and follow label instructions.
Welcome back to Ag PhD Radio. Brian Hefty here, live in the Morton studio. If you've got a question for us, it's 844-44-AG-PHD. We're talking alfalfa production a little bit today. And first on the show, we've got Danny Titus. He is with AgriLiquid. Danny, thanks for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so when it comes to fertility for alfalfa, I guess the first question I will ask you, boron. We have a lot of farmers who are, number one, knowing and thinking, hey, alfalfa needs a fair amount of boron. But then on the other hand, they go, well, wait a second, boron's super toxic. So how am I going to get it out there at the right level at the right time? Do you have any suggestions for us with boron in terms of alfalfa production?
Sure. You can, by using our boron, you can put that on. That could go into a tank mix when they're doing an insecticide application or herbicide application. It could even be put through the pivot if it's underneath the center pivot and get that boron application on that way.
How about rates? What rates? Let me put it to you this way, and I'll phrase it how I usually go. I try to maximize production on my farm, which means I need lots of fertility, which also means I'm willing to push the envelope a little bit. So in other words, how far are you willing to push it on boron? What kind of a level could I go to? How much could I put on at any one time over the top of the crop?
Well, with our product, it's a 8-pound equivalent per gallon of boron. And with our product, I recommend anywhere from 1 pint to 1 quart, depending on what the soil test levels are of boron. And so a quart, which would be the equivalent of 2 pounds of boron, would be about as high as what I would go in one application.
All right. How about in terms of other fertility? I mean, potassium, I know, is a really big deal. But what else stands out to you? I mean, what do you get the most questions about when it comes to alfalfa?
You know, probably potassium is the number one, because alfalfa is just a huge user of potassium. But also one to really pay attention to is manganese. Alfalfa is a crop that manganese is an important nutrient on. So that's probably the other one that we get into applications probably the most, other than potassium there.
Do you have anything as far as, let's say it's this spring and the guy is going to put in new seeding. Is there any separate advice you would have for the new seeding versus basically any time in the life of the stand?
Sure. On a new seeding, you know, alfalfa is going to at some point start making its own nitrogen. But with new seeding alfalfa, we've got to get a little nitrogen out there to, you know, get that crop off and going before it starts to nodulate and produce its own. So when we're looking at new seeding alfalfa, that's one thing that we like to have in there, put in some high energy in, down with our ProGerm, which would be our phosphate product, and potassium products of Calibrate or SureKe. Those are kind of the main things there. And then really pay attention to those micronutrient levels. Micronutrients, very important for good alfalfa.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked about boron and manganese. Is there anything else in terms of micronutrients? Or I guess you could throw sulfur into that too. I mean, any last comments you got for us? Any other big nutrients that you often talk to farmers about in alfalfa?
Well, no, the biggest ones are usually the phosphate and the potassium, but just depending on what a soil test looks like, that, you know, number one, need to take that soil test, make sure what we've got out there, what our needs are going to be. If we need zinc out there, we need zinc. If we need iron, we not need iron. But soil test is by far the biggest thing, to make sure that we put out there what we do need to raise a good crop.
All right, we've been talking to Danny Titus with AgriLiquid. Danny, thanks for the time today. Appreciate the insight.
You bet, Brian. No problem.
All right, let's go next to, we've got Lowell Sandell on with us. He is with Valent. Lowell, how are things going for you today?
Doing great. How are you doing?
Excellent. So we're talking a little about alfalfa production. I guess where I wanted to start with you is the last couple of years have been exceptionally wet in a lot of areas. And that has hurt the alfalfa in several different ways. Hurt the root systems. It's hurt in terms of nodulation. It's hurt in terms of just microbes in the soil. So I know one of the products that you guys have at Valent is MycoApply Endoprime, where you've got more micro, you can get more mycorrhizae fungi in the soil. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and how a farmer could put that on his alfalfa?
Yeah. The points you make are very, very appropriate. And to kind of follow on what the previous gentleman said, a lot of times when we're establishing a new stand or even a stand that's been established and the roots are, or the stand is thinning out a little bit, something like a mycorrhizal fungi product that colonates, the roots, can be beneficial, particularly in that newly seeded stand. You know, as the previous gentleman said, alfalfa uses a lot of phosphorus and potassium, which are relatively immobile nutrients in the soil. And if the alfalfa is colonized by a mycorrhizal fungi product, that can help extract some of those more immobile nutrients in the soil. Can be pretty important in getting that stand up and going and getting good production out of the first year.
Yeah, we absolutely see that in really every crop. I mean, we've talked for years about fallow syndrome in corn. It all has to do with mycorrhizae fungi in the soil, and that's MycoApply Endoprime. So as we're talking about that, we do get a lot of questions from organic producers. Can they use MycoApply Endoprime in organic production?
Actually, the one that's the product that's labeled for alfalfa is MycoApply Endoprime Granular, and that is an approved product for organic production. The way folks would, one of the primary ways folks would apply this is as a hopper box treatment. The granules are about the same size as alfalfa seed, so it doesn't settle out as you go across the field in the hopper box, and you get a nice uniform application when it's applied that way. And the typical rate that we recommend with that is 1.5 to 2 pounds of this granular product per acre, and that kind of fits the alfalfa market out there.
Talking about organic production, just continuing on with that, you also have a product for insect control in organic production. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, for those folks that are have the organic alfalfa, Pyganic is a organic approved insecticide. It's a pyrethrin based insecticide, and you know, we've been seeing reports of some cutworms and even some things like aphids and so forth, particularly down in Kansas and moving up into Nebraska here. And if a grower has an organic alfalfa production, using something like Pyganic for a quick knockdown can be beneficial to keeping insects out, or at least controlled, and preserving some of the foliage.
Yeah, absolutely. Lowell, we got about 30 seconds left. Do you want to give us a quick comment on Chateau and Select Max for alfalfa?
Sure. A lot of times in established alfalfa, we get calls on grass control, and Select Max is an excellent option to control both perennial grasses and annual grasses. Encourage folks to keep the rate up and apply early in alfalfa. And then if folks have Palmer amaranth or small seeded broadleaf problems in alfalfa, using 4 ounces of Chateau is an excellent way to keep residual control of Palmer amaranth.
All right. Well, hey, thanks, Lowell. Really appreciate the time. Stay tuned. This is Ag PhD Radio.
What do you think of when you hear Palmer amaranth or water hemp? If you use Fierce herbicide in your soybean fields, you don't have to think about them at all. With two effective modes of action and up to 8 weeks of residual control, Fierce takes on even the toughest weeds like water hemp and Palmer amaranth. Take control of your soybean fields and get incentives from Bayer Plus Rewards when you choose the power of Fierce herbicide. Talk to your local retailer today to put Fierce to work in your fields. Always read and follow label directions.
Before it's too late and white mold becomes a problem, you need to ask your seed dealer for heads-up seed treatment. When raising soybeans in the Midwest, you know the risk of being caught unprepared. As heard on AgPhD, there are several steps you can take prior to planting for a successful management plan against white mold. Compatible and cost-effective season-long protection starts now by asking your seed dealer to apply Heads Up to your 2020 bean seed order. For more information, visit headsupst.com.
You need a powerful herbicide to fight the war on weeds. Bellum is Rotam North America's mesotrione herbicide, and it fights against the annual broadleaf weeds attacking your cornfields. Winning this battle means higher yields, lower cost to you, and maximized profitability. For long-lasting residual weed control, check out Evinco Vilify and our newest mix, Rixa. For application, flexibility, and season-long control, that's Evinco Vilify and Rixa, powered by Bellum. For more information, visit bellumherbicide.com. That's B-E-L-L-U-M herbicide.com.
How do you know when to run your grain bin fans? There's an app for that. With the Steps GMS app, you can manually turn your fans on and off from your smartphone. You can also configure the Steps GMS app to automatically turn fans on when the humidity or temperature is ideal to keep your grain in top quality condition. Save yourself some time and take the guesswork out of managing your stored grain with the Steps GMS app. Contact us at stepsgms.com for more information.
We planted early February and have all good emergence. So far, we can't find any condition that the wheels haven't worked. I can just say that.
Closing the seed trench behind the planter is essential to establishing yields in the fall. Introducing the Germinator Closing Wheel from Farm Shop MFG. Designed and built by a farmer who is tired of seeing poor stands because of uneven emergence, the Germinator is here to give your crop the strong start it needs for maximum yield. For more information, visit us at farmshopmfg.com.
You deserve to have a building that will last for generations. With more than 110 years of experience and thousands of satisfied customers, Morton Buildings is the industry leader you can trust. Unlike other construction companies, you work with Morton Buildings craftsmen from conception to completion. There's no better time to buy. Lock in your new building for 2020 today. Contact your local Morton sales office or visit mortonbuildings.com.
Thanks for tuning in today to Ag PhD Radio, talking a little about alfalfa production. We're going to get to the Ag PhD mailbag, or get back to the Ag PhD mailbag a little later in the show as well. And if you want to get your question in, it's radio@agphd.com. All right, so next on the show, we got Glenn calling in from out in Wisconsin. Hi, Glenn. How are you today?
Cold and dodging snow showers.
Yeah, it's funny. I got a 15-year-old daughter, and she goes, "What's the white stuff in the air?" I go, "Jetta, that's snow." She goes, "It can't be snow. It's 40 degrees out." I go, "Well, that's what it is." Yep. So talking alfalfa production a little bit, I know you've raised alfalfa for a long time on your farm. What are maybe the top two or three tips you have for having good success with an alfalfa crop?
Well, we've no-tilled for 20 years. That's the only way we seed it, is no-till. And we use Roundup Ready and seed. And I guess a good seed bed, you know, firm seed soil contact, and weed control, and your nutrients, and good to go.
Okay, so talk to us about the no-till seeding, because I think a lot of people go, hey, wait a second, if I'm going to have my drill out there and I'm going to get this good seed-to-soil contact that you mentioned, what crop are you usually following that you're able to do that in a no-till kind of environment?
Well, our local co-op have two Great Plains drills, no-till drills.
Okay.
And I have literally seed it into every crop residue possible. Typically, we used to always use soybean stubble, go right into that. Of course, we are a dairy farm, so we do remove all the bedding residue.
Oh, gotcha.
Bedding, so.
Yep.
But now we've also don't need the soybean stubble for bedding. We will have them spread it right when they combine, and that works well too. So then this past year, see, we lost all our alfalfa. First time in my life I've ever done that.
Too much rain?
So we actually put 10 acres right into grain corn stubble, bailed off the corn stalks, and went right into that.
So how you lost your alfalfa, was it too much rain last year?
That was winter kill. We had about an inch and a half of rain in December, and she iced everything up, and then she was kind of thawed off a little bit in the open ground of just ice, and then she got just cold and, you know, 36 below. She just took her out.
Yeah, it was a brutal winter last year, that is for sure. So in terms of how you get your alfalfa up and growing relatively quickly in the spring, you mentioned fertility a little bit, but is there anything you do to help it along? I mean, what's your first application each spring?
Well, first thing we'll do with whatever residue field is out there, I mean, it's you don't want a lot of residue, so, but well, I don't typically put alfalfa in until after the 20th of May.
Sure.
The ground is really warmed up good. We do our corn and soybean planting first, and then we harvest rye. So typically now what our plan is we take the rye, winter rye off for heifer feed, and then we've been the last few years planting into that. So if that's the case, we just go, as soon as we harvest it, we can go and plant right away the next day. We'll drill it in, and as it greens up, well, first we'll throw our fertilizer out, chop our feed off, and then put our fertilizer on. And then we'll seed it down, and then after it's ripe, we'll kind of shoot out again and green up. But your alfalfa, it'll show up in 5 days. And then being it's Roundup, that's the only thing we do is pass a Roundup, and that's it.
How about insects? I don't think you've mentioned anything yet about insects. Do you have any insect issues?
I haven't did anything with insects for years.
Nice.
Maybe some leafhoppers later in the year, maybe in the new seeding will hit, you know, but nothing,
sure.
Nothing else really to deal with.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, Glenn, thanks a lot for calling in today. Really appreciate hearing a little bit about alfalfa production on your farm. Sounds like things are going good with that. And certainly hope you don't have any more of this winter kill coming up in the next few years or anything.
Yeah. I got one more point to make.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm really a strong believer in using gypsum.
Oh, yeah.
We don't use ammonium sulfate anymore. We've went to gypsum. And the benefits you get from that gypsum, we don't even know all the benefits of it yet. So,
all right. Yep.
Important to be your real key.
Yeah. Yeah. Important tip. Yeah. We have more people, I think, using gypsum all the time. Well, again, we've been talking to Glenn from out in Wisconsin. Glenn, thanks for the time today. Appreciate it.
Okay. You bet. Bye.
All right. Let's go next out to the state of Washington. We got Drex calling in from out there. Hey, Drex, how are you?
Good. How are you this afternoon?
Excellent. So we're talking about alfalfa production today, and you probably heard just a little bit about what Glenn was saying there. What do you have to add in terms of how you get good alfalfa on your farm?
Well, we're fortunate here. We're in the southeastern corner of Washington State, and we've got abundant irrigation and a good long season. Our alfalfa typically is established in the fall. Late summer, early fall, following a crop of wheat or potatoes, some of our other crops that are in the rotation as well. And I think one of the biggest things, just like about any crop that a farmer puts in the ground, is seedbed preparation. A good, firm, moist seedbed is wonderful for us out here where we have the benefit of irrigation. We don't have some of the trials that some of the other fellas fight. Our soil is anywhere from straight sand to sandy loam, and so having that soil moisture just right contributes to quick takeoff, and you see that seed out of the ground in 5 days, just like we already heard. You see it out really quick. But the other thing that good seed bed allows us is even emergence, and we're able to control depth so much better when we have a good seed bed and get a good start. That's the biggest difference I see between a stand that's in its first springtime after a fall establishment versus a 1 or 2 year old stand is just plant population. And so I guess that brings into my second point, anything you can do to encourage longevity and high plant population through all of your production years is critical. And probably one of the big tools we use is our State Hay Growers Association, Washington State University joint variety trials to kind of help us rank how these alfalfa varieties do over a number of years of harvest in the field.
Yeah, you bet. Hey, I've got a question for you on alfalfa irrigation. What advice do you have for someone out there who is irrigating their alfalfa? What kind of timing are you looking for? I mean, what are your triggers where you say, yep, I got to make sure I'm running the pivots over?
Being as this time of year, we've had the luxury of having our irrigation on for just about a month now. And we've had some frosty nights from time to time, but early season irrigation, I think, is a practice, if you have it available, that pays dividends through the whole year. When you get in the heat of the summer months, you haven't robbed that deep moisture to grow your spring crop. If you can maybe even be fortunate enough to push a little bit of water down to the deeper parts of the root zone in this springtime, That's a big help, and especially for us, our ground is very hilly. We don't have a lot of flat ground, and so we fight runoff in the pivots. We fight wheel tracks, and we fight ponding in the bottom if you try and run too heavy. And so what helps us is being able to get heavy water on between first and second, or between second and third cuttings when that hay has been starved for water. Maybe it's almost in a harvest induced kind of dormancy, and you've got to wake it back up. You've got to give it a good shot of water. But
gotcha.
We're not flat here, so we can't just pour it to it. We've got to
little bit at a time,
as aggressive as we can, but still meter things in.
Yep, gotcha. All right, again, we've been talking to Drex, who called in from out in Washington. Drex, thanks for the time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye bye.
All right, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
What do you think of when you hear Palmer amaranth or water hemp? If you use Fierce herbicide in your soybean fields, you don't have to think about them at all. With two effective modes of action and up to 8 weeks of residual control, Fierce takes on even the toughest weeds like water hemp and Palmer amaranth. Take control of your soybean fields and get incentives from Bayer Plus Rewards when you choose the power of Fierce herbicide. Talk to your local retailer today to put Fierce to work in your fields. Always read and follow label directions.
Heat, drought, wind, hail, northern corn leaf blight, gray leaf spot. If your corn is under stress, you are too. Get Veltima fungicide, swift activity, with fast payback, an expanded application window. Makes life simple, and it's the secure choice. With powerful residual for visibly healthier corn. Swift, simple, secure. Veltima fungicide. Call your BASF rep today. Always read and follow label directions. Veltima fungicide is not registered in all states.
High-yield corn growers know that feeding the crop and soil are keys to maximizing yield potential.
Nutec's EDA and Reverb are specifically formulated to help manage limiting factors associated with today's farming conditions. Nutec's EDA works within the plant to support nutrient mobility and utilization. Reverb focuses on the soil, providing beneficial trace elements which help condition the root zone for optimal microbial activity. Low use rates and superb tank mix compatibility make Nutec's EDA and Reverb no-brainers in the high-yield grower toolbox.
You're all set with the 4x4 turbo diesel truck. How about some options? Spray and bed liner?
Absolutely.
Tailgate step and Nerf bars?
Gotta have them.
Tie down hooks and stainless steel toolbox?
You know it.
Tinted windows?
Of course.
Options are good. That's as true in the field as it is with your pickup. In addition to taking care of tough weeds, new Open Sky herbicide gives you more rotational choices than ever before and an easy-to-handle formulation.
Gooseneck tow package?
Yep.
Discover more Open Sky details at openskyherbicide.com.
The Guardian Air Twin Spray Nozzle from Hypro produces a twin spray pattern with air-inducted droplets for superior coverage, even in dense canopies. Be effective and efficient with your spray application this season with the Guardian Air Twin. Hypro, helping you spray better.
How much yield did you lose the moment you planted your seed? Introducing the Germinator Closing Wheel from Farm Shop MFG. Designed and built by a farmer tired of seeing yield loss from poor stands, the Germinator gives your crop the strong start it needs for maximum yield. Visit farmshopmfg.com.
Welcome back to Ag PhD Radio. I am Brian Hefty, live in the Morton studio. Got my brother Darren joining back in with us as well. We're going to jump back into the Ag PhD mailbag here in just a second, but I guess just to wrap up on alfalfa production. So you heard a lot of great things today. I think one of the things that stood out the most from the farmers calling in was just making sure you have a good seed bed. We want to get that seed out of the ground as quickly as possible. Now, I will just say I'm not a real huge believer in having another crop along with it. A lot of people in our area years ago used to put a nurse crop with it. I don't love that. I understand the concept of it and everything else, but I do get concerned simply because if we're trying to raise two crops at the same time, neither one of them turns out as good as we want it. And I think Drex had a great point. He said, whatever we do, it needs to be focused on the longevity of that stand. We want to keep it going and in great shape for years, not just in year one or in year two. And so anyway, we would just tell you, make sure you're scouting for weeds, for insects. We've got plenty of options in terms of control for bugs. And, you know, to some degree for weeds too, we don't have a lot of options, but we have a few options. The thing that we would tell you is you want to get started with great weed control day one. We really prefer using a half a gallon of Eptam. It's got to be instantly incorporated, but you work that in, then you go out and you seed your alfalfa. And generally speaking, we've got the weeds under control for a long time because post-emerge, yeah, you can use Roundup if it's Roundup alfalfa. Otherwise, you're talking Buctrol, Pursuiter Raptor, and maybe a little bit of Butyrac. In terms of broadleaf, the broadleaf side, in terms of the grass side, you got Select Max and just about all those post-emerge grass killers. So we have a lot of grass options, but not a lot of broadleaf options. And then beyond that, it's just making sure we have good balanced fertility and we're doing everything we can to keep that stand healthy as long as possible, cutting it at the right time and all that. So anyway, Darren, any last comments you got for us?
No, it's just a perennial crop. So you get different opportunities. Like you say, you've got to set the table well with fertility and all those other things you got to fix. And then I just look at it as whenever you get a crop like alfalfa that you're going to cut multiple times each year, you have multiple times to try different things. You have multiple times to fix things that you find that are wrong. And I like that managers that are really aggressive and trying to do the best job they possibly can for every single cutting, they're going to win. There's no doubt about it.
Now, I didn't throw this in here, but I really should. With the immobile nutrients in soil, the ones that don't move well in soil, so I'm talking about phosphorus, zinc, there are a number of them out there, even potassium to some degree. I mean, if you've got sand like Drex did with irrigation, yes, potassium can move. But in all our heavy soils without a lot of rainfall, potassium isn't moving very far either. So here's my point. In the year that you're going to seed, that's your chance to get some fertility down deep in the soil. I would really encourage you, load it up then and get it down in the soil. So if you get some nutrients down at 4, 6, 8 inches deep, the ones that don't leach through the soil, like phosphorus, zinc, and those, get them down there. So now your alfalfa crop has the opportunity to extract those over the next 3 years, 4 years, however long that stand is in there. Usually you could spend the same number of dollars on fertility through the life of the entire stand, but if you put them on early, you put them on up front, you get them down in the ground, you're going to get much better uptake, you're going to get much better overall results and tonnage. So just keep working on balancing your soil, get the nutrients down a little bit, and then you're in good shape. All right, let's jump back into the Ag PhD mailbag. This one comes from, doesn't give us a name, but we had done a Weed of the Week on our television show, Absinthe Wormwood, and he said this. So you spray chemicals on the wormwood and grass to kill the weeds, and then you let the cows eat the chemical-ridden grass, but it's okay to complain about cows eating wormwood and tainting the milk. Seems pretty backwards. Well, look, you know, we talk about this all the time. Like even earlier in the show, we were talking about an insecticide that can get used in organic production. A lot of these things are naturally derived anymore. So by the way, that product we were talking about for insect control and organic production was Pyganic, and that's labeled for a lot of different crops right now. It's in the pyrethroid family, same type of thing that we're using out for insecticide or for insect control in most crops, where we'll use products like, let's say it's Silencer or Kendo or Mustang Max, whatever. Those are all pyrethroids too. That's just, they're the synthetic versions. Well, the naturally derived pyrethrin, that's approved for organic production. So it's basically the same thing. A lot of times, like in pastures, we talk about Tordon or, you know, many of these milestone, many of these products that are very safe to livestock. And the whole thing is this. Before anything gets labeled, really in any country, there are tremendous amounts of studies that go into it to determine, hey, what's ending up in the food supply? And keep in mind, plants are going to metabolize a lot of these herbicides, so they're gone. They disappear most of the time before the cow ever even eats it. But even if the cow does eat it, how much actually gets into the cow? How long does it take to get rid of that? All these studies get done so we know that our food supply is safe. And yes, I realize that may seem weird to you, but when we say the word chemical, I don't like that word. Because quite frankly, a lot of these things anymore, they are so much safer than, I mean, when you think chemical, you think, oh my goodness, super, super crazy dangerous. A lot of these things, no way. They are actually quite safe to humans and livestock. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying everything is, and I'm not trying to tell you that, oh, we should all eat chemicals. No, I'm just simply saying having absinthe wormwood in your field is way worse than spraying a herbicide and getting that thing under control. All right.
Hey, Brandon, add something else. Since you're talking about absinthe wormwood, one of the reasons, and I like the reference with dairy cows, one of the reasons that dairy farmers are so concerned about absinthe wormwood is it does change the flavor of the milk and not in
exactly
a good way.
Yep.
So they need to have that out of there. And yes, you may be thinking, wait, absinthe, that sounds like a different kind of liquor. Yes, guess what? They even use that in liquor. So they might want that flavor in some things, but not in others. And there are different restrictions for grazing, whether an animal is lactating or not, if it's beef production or not. And there's certain times that animals could be in there and certain times they can't. And every farmer and rancher knows that. And they know, hey, if this one has a 2-week restriction where after you spray, you have to stay out of there for at least 2 weeks, that's what farmers do. That's why we use rotational grazing. That's why you see so many different fence lines out in many of these pastures. They can fence animals into one part of the pasture or the other when they're taking care of the weeds.
Yep, great points. All right, next question here comes from Chet. He says, hey, guys, the other day on the radio show, I didn't quite catch what you were saying about one of the reasons not to plant corn following sugar beets. Was it something about the microbacteria activity? Go ahead, Darren.
Well, they just don't host mycorrhizal fungi, and that's what helps bring phosphorus and some other nutrients into the plant. And so what you can get sometimes is what looks like fallow syndrome early in the season, where you're going to see corn that's a little purple. It's just not getting the fertility in. So you can apply mycorrhizal fungi right in the furrow, products like Endoprime, for example, and you can also put highly available liquid starter fertilizer right in the furrow. We use ProGerminator in those situations, and you can get by. But, yep, you just have to be aware of that with your rotation. You may use a cover crop after the sugar beets if you have time. I know in a lot of areas, especially in the north, they don't have time for that, though.
Yeah, we talked about MycoApply Endoprime a little bit earlier in the show. And just to restate this, we are super concerned in a lot of situations coming out of the last 2 years where there was so much flooding. And so it wasn't just, hey, we have a host crop like sugar beets or radishes that, or I shouldn't say a host crop, we have a crop that doesn't host mycorrhizal fungi. So when you plant a crop like corn after just straight radishes or sugar beets, you very often can see this fallow syndrome. But in addition to that, with the flooding, that killed a lot of the mycorrhizal fungi. They have to have a host plant, number one, and they have to have a good environment, number two, which means lots of oxygen. When there was all that water there, they didn't have the oxygen, and a lot of them died. So we are very concerned about that going into this spring. So if you weren't able to get a cover crop out there, get something growing on that ground last year, you had some prevent plant acres, then we do consider products like MycoApply Endoprime to fit very well. All right, we'll continue with your questions coming up right after this.
Worried about glyphosate-resistant weeds and grasses in your corn? Unleash the power of new Impact Z herbicide and get the early post-application advantage you've been waiting for. Save $3 per acre when you combine Impact Z with a qualifying insecticide purchase. Go to buy2save3.com for details. Buy2save3 is a service mark, and Impact Z is a trademark owned by Amvac Chemical Corporation. All rights reserved. Impact Z is a restricted-use pesticide. Always read and follow label instructions.
This is a seed bag. This bag is made of Kraft paper with a cellophane liner and provides nothing for seed growth. This is a seed bed. It was prepared with Case IH soil management tools. It optimizes everything from nutrient access to water infiltration to create the perfect environment for early uniform emergence. Get to know why your seed bed drives productivity at caseih.com/soil management.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Customer service goes a long way when trying something new. Ryan Shaw from Michigan shares how Soil Warrior helped him transition to strip tillage in his operation.
The Soil Warrior guys, they are amazing to work with. They made this jump in this transition extremely painless. One question that I get all the time is, how is the service and everything? And I said, well, actually, I get better service from them than I typically do my dealers uptown. They're just amazing.
More info at soilwarrior.com.
Your land is a legacy, a challenge from those who tended it before you, to build on their foundations. At Corteva Agriscience, we understand what it means to be the stewards of a legacy. We embrace the challenge of building on the foundation of Dow AgroSciences to maintain your trust, to bring new solutions, to help you care for your land. See how we can help build your legacy at rangeandpasture.com.
Challenging field conditions often make harvest difficult. Can your corn head handle it? The GTS X10 corn head from Agra US is a rugged, cost-effective alternative to heavier, more traditional heads. Constructed of durable yet lightweight aluminum, the X10 puts less strain on your combine without losing harvest effectiveness. And it is 40% lighter than traditional heads, reducing field compaction in those less than ideal conditions. For more information, give us a call at 833-4-AGRA-US.
Welcome back to Ag PhD Radio. We are right in the middle of the Ag PhD mailbag. where we answer your questions. If you've got any questions for us, just email us, radio@agphd.com, or you can give us a call, too. We've got a little bit of time yet today, 844-44-AG-PHD. Our next question is from Austin in Illinois. He sent us some soil tests, and he wants to know, what should my soil test levels be for the different micronutrients? So, Darren, just talk to us real quick. Let's call it a minute or less, about the five typical micronutrients we're usually talking about and the kind of levels we're usually looking for. Do we have Darren? And I guess we lost Darren. Oh, hey, there we go. Now we got him. Go ahead, Darren.
Okay, it's a little bit difficult because soils vary, and of course, you know, especially when you look at one of those micronutrients being boron and it being leachable, it may be a little debatable about how much you want to have out there, and we'll talk a lot about our heavy soils in a low rainfall area. We're pushing parts per million. Normally, we'll see soil tests at 0.5 or so, and we're pushing for 2 or 3 parts per million, maybe even a little bit more. We're still learning on that one.
By the way, so this is a 19 CEC soil. He said he sent me these tests, and he goes, it's 1/3 acre grids. So he's got lots of tests here. It's a pretty small field he's got. But anyway, small grids, but fairly heavy soil at a 19 CEC. Go ahead.
What do you see for variability, too, Brian? Is it
crazy,
really variable on the micros, or are they pretty pretty flat?
It's not maybe necessarily as bad in terms of variability, but yeah, this is a huge thing, and this is why we tell you all the time, or encourage you, I should say, please do some small grids at least one time in your life, and then you'll see the variability that's out there, and you can start to fix that. Because, for example, like on phosphorus, a major nutrient, he's got as little as 34 pounds in one spot and as high as 256 pounds in another spot. With his zinc, he's as high as 21.4 pounds and as little as 6.3 pounds. So yeah, there are some that don't vary a lot in terms of the micronutrients. His copper doesn't vary much. His manganese doesn't vary much. But I mean, if you look at zinc, varies quite a bit. Phosphorus varies quite a bit. Even the boron varies a fair amount. So anyway.
Okay,
so the
I was just curious about that on those micros, and that's the one thing that I was going to say. In a lot of tests that I've looked at, we see a lot of variance in the N, P, and K because they've been broadcast applied at a straight rate for many years.
Exactly.
And we've got varying levels of crop removal. When you have 200 bushel corn and 50 bushel corn in the same field, obviously you're going to see some differences in how much of those nutrients are left. On the micro side, the plants aren't taking out that much. But certainly we want to be up to some minimum levels at least. And we're learning more about that all the time. It depends on the testing method. With copper, we'd like to see at least a couple parts per million. With manganese, it might be at least 20 parts per million, depending on the type of test that you're running. Another test, it might be a little higher. On iron, we'd like to see the iron higher than the manganese, at least 20 parts per million. And then, let's see, zinc. Zinc, that kind of depends on how high your phosphorus is. So we'd like to see that zinc be maybe at a 10-to-1 ratio with phosphorus, but we'd like to see a minimum as well of 2 or 3 parts per million there.
Okay, and you know, actually, he's in pretty good shape on most of his micronutrients. That's not my big concern. My big concern here is his phosphorus is way too low in certain areas of the field, and his potassium is way too low in almost every single area in the field. He's got a lot of ones and twos in terms of percent base saturation K. So, Austin, our suggestion for you is start bumping the major nutrients, P and K and even sulfur. And yes, I mean, if you want to do a little bit with some of the micros, that's fine. Like especially boron, that one's exceptionally low for you. But for the most part, not too terrible bad. And all of his pH, by the way, was really good. Okay, next question comes from Jason in Iowa. He says, hi, guys, I've got two of your apps. The app that shows nutrient use and breaks it down by Stover and grain. How much and when are those nutrients available for the following crop? Go ahead, Darren.
Coming out of residue, that's a great question. It depends on how fast that residue is breaking down.
Right.
So, for example, if you're in the south and you've got all kinds of heat and you're going to double crop, well, you're going to break residue down really fast. In the north, when you just barely harvest the corn in October, let's say, and the ground is frozen, well, you aren't going to have a whole lot of microbial activity. So it's going to be mid-summer next year by the time some of that starts to break down, and it might take the full next year for it to break down. So what I look at is when I'm pulling soil tests in the fall, I've got a pretty good picture of what I'm going to have for early in the season, plus whatever I apply.
Yep. And he also asks, are there products that can break that down faster, break that residue down faster, and make it more available quicker?
Sure, because we're talking about high carbon residue. And for that to break down, the microorganisms in the soil that are going to do that work, they need nitrogen at a balance of 16:1 carbon to nitrogen or less. And if you've got something like corn stalks that are 60 parts carbon to one part nitrogen, well, you just have to do the math. You're going to need to add some nitrogen out there to make that happen, and you're going to need some heat. So again, like I bring back the example, you harvest in October and it's frozen. Well, you don't have any heat anymore, so the microbes aren't working out in your field. Wait till the spring, throw a little bit of extra nitrogen out there at that residue to break it down faster. I also like some of the microbial products out on the market. The one that we use on our farm is called D-Comp that has over 70 different microorganisms in it designed to help break that residue down.
Okay, another question. This one is from Bob, and it ties right into what you were just talking about. Will all the corn starch break down for the next season if using no-till, or do they have to be like mowed down, tilled in, whatever? So just talk about that a little bit, maybe for no-till versus conventional till.
Well, with conventional till, you're mixing soil with that residue, and the soil is where all those microorganisms are. So you're going to speed that process up, no doubt about it, and chopping up the stalks helps. So in no-till, that's one thing that you could do potentially is use a stalk chopper or have a chopping corn head so you can get those pieces in smaller bits. And also, if you're cutting them at a slight angle, you expose a little bit more of that pulp in the middle of the stalk, and you have more surface area for those microbes to break things down. So that would be something to think about. It's going to be slower in no-till than in conventional.
Okay, next one. We had done a video on how farmers avoid water pollution. Actually, that was our farm basics topic a while back on Ag PhD TV. And this person who writes in says, hey, it's a good video, although disappointing explanation of hypoxia. If you're suggesting that hypoxia occurs naturally between fresh and salt water, it would have been good to include this explanation in the video to prove your point. Without the facts, telling people who aren't sure to get over it doesn't work. There isn't really, I hate to say it, but a lot of more information there. I mean, whenever fresh water meets salt water, there's a zone of hypoxia. I don't care what nutrients are in there or anything else. That's just the way it is. So if you're out in the ocean and you've got salt water and then you have fresh water, well, let's put it this way. Take a saltwater fish and throw it into fresh water, or take a freshwater fish and throw that into salt water and see how well things go.
I would say this too. When you hear experts talking about this zone of hypoxia, listen really closely to what they say and then respectfully ask them the question, okay, talk to us about 100 years ago, before there was fertilizer, before farmers were even farming some of the ground in the United States. What did you see then? And when they tell you, well, the zone of hypoxia was virtually the same size as it is now. That should tell you something, that it's not about fertilizer and it's not about, hey, our farming practices have changed. In fact, our farming practices now, we have less erosion than we had a generation ago. So if it was all about the erosion and all about fertility products farmers were using, we would have seen a huge adjustment in the last 30 years, and we really haven't.
Okay, so when you look at the government's website on and their National Ocean Service, they'll say right in here, stratification in the water column, which occurs when less dense freshwater from an when less dense freshwater mixes with heavier salt water, that's one natural cause of hypoxia. And what Darren was just talking about with the zone of hypoxia, just to restate that. And where I first learned about this is about 10 years ago, and I was talking to one of the foremost experts on that zone of hypoxia. And I just asked him, okay, 100 years ago, what was the size? Because I asked him first, how far back do you have records? And he goes, oh, about 100 years. I said, okay, if you have records, tell me roughly what was the size of the zone of hypoxia then? It's about the same size as today. And I'm going, what? Why are we even talking about this? This should be a non-issue. If it wasn't for our media, it wouldn't be an issue. there's no problem in terms of this zone of hypoxia and, oh, farmers are creating the issue. That's nonsense. Come on. Farmers, unfortunately, get the blame for a lot of things. Farmers should be getting the credit. Like right now in our world, let's face it, we need farmers worse than ever. We all need to eat. We're trying to get through this whole COVID-19 thing. So I just want to say a big thank you to farmers out there. And also, before we wrap things up, thanks to our production staff, our guests, and anybody who wrote in with questions. And thanks to you for listening. Be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio.